You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2010 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the first class in a series given by Brother John Warner on the subject, Judges. This class is titled, Overview and History.
I'd like to welcome and introduce John Warner from both Southern California and Canada, right? We never know where he's at, actually. Northern California, sorry. Isn't that the same thing?
And that's interesting that everybody reacts when we say Southern and Northern. It's one of the tragedies that happens in the book of Judges, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Quite seriously, it's one of the tragedies that the neighboring people don't get along, even though they're from the same origin. And it adumbrates history and certainly our society even up to this moment. But, first of all, I became interested in the period of the Judges and specifically in the book of the Judges when, just out of college, now this was shortly after California became a state, so I'm relying on what my wife calls long-term memory. But we had a wonderful study in the Redwoods. I think there were only maybe 25 or 6 raid, you remember. There weren't many. They got together in the Redwoods. And the idea was to look at a book that... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm usually a loudmouth. The idea was to look at a book that there was no contemporary Christadelphian writing about. And in those days, as I say, it was shortly after we became a state, there was no book on the Judges, which is wonderful. And I commend this process to any and all of you. Get together 4, 5, 6 if you can. Thrash it out without looking at the experts, because remember, that's only a drip under pressure. I mean, it really is. Any of us who have been lauded as, you know, great painters or experts on history or anything else knows the fallacy in that kind of reasoning, the God King. And we still elevate people and say, oh, you know, that's a wonderful book. And it's not that I haven't since read Brother Harry and a few other of our community writing about the period. But do that as the last resort. So we thrashed out the book of Judges. I think I had Osnell and Ehud, and love them to this day, even though for most of you they're just names. But the idea was to really look at the book and see why it's there. Why has God included some books? You see, as Christadelphians, very often we get to the Song of Songs, which we commonly call the Song of Solomon, even though it probably should be, in the Hebrew, the Song for Solomon. And we say, well, we can't read that in public. Or we get to the 20th and the 21st chapter of Judges and say, well, we shouldn't read that in meeting. After all, the reason that we read the second and the third portion is to avoid these things, right? I mean, I understand not reading Chronicles because that can be an alliteration problem, to put it mildly. But quite seriously, when we do that, and I'm being very serious now, we are saying we are in this age a little more mature and a little wiser, Almighty God, and we've decided not to do this. All Scripture is given by inspiration of God. We always quote that. All Scripture. Unless we decide to excise certain passages, they all have a benefit. As the NIV says, they are God-breathed, and they are profitable. One of my favorite passages from the book of Romans, and you don't have to turn to it, I'm just referring to the 15th chapter in the 4th verse says, for whatever was written in former days was written for our instruction, that by steadfastness and by the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. Now, sometimes we have a tendency to look at the Scriptures, particularly the Old Testament, and say, well, I look at the Old Testament and I just see deities. I see idolatry, adultery, stupidity. And yet what Paul says, the Scriptures give us hope. If for no other reason, it's possible to sum up all of the Old Testament and look at it and say that man is pretty stupid, but God is wonderful, kind, compassionate, and forgiving. I have adventure, romance, and mystery, and I'm not being facetious. It's got it all. And I think that's why, as young fellows, we decide to look at the book of the Judges. Why is it there? It has some horrible things in it. In fact, when Paul writes to the Corinthians, he pretty well sums up the same kind of things that we find. He says, but rather I wrote to you, and you remember in the context he is talking about incest and problems in Corinth. I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with immoral men, not at all meaning the immoral of this world or the greedy or the robbers or the idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. But rather I wrote to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother if he's guilty of immorality or greed or an idolater, reviler, a reveler, excuse me, a drunkard or a robber, not even to eat with such a one. Now, we tend to forget that in the first century they had all of those, and we also tend to forget that in the 21st century we have some of that, and we ourselves are sometimes guilty of those things. Which takes us back to that wonderful promise by Paul that when we read the Scriptures, we have hope. Because we might be foolish, but God is wonderful. And His Son is wonderful. I have a picture of one of the judges there. And you can see that they were really exceptional people. Happy, uplifting. From the time of Joshua's death, if we look at the book of Judges, we might say the period 1400 to 1050, and we're probably fairly close. Essentially, until the time that Saul falls on Mount Gilboa. Now, it's true that Samuel covers beyond the period of Judges. Tomorrow, Christian's going to take just a brief look, as I remember, at Samuel. And Samuel is absolutely wonderful. He is a judge, and even though he's a Kohathite and not an Aaronite, that is, he is not a priest, he acts as a priest, he acts as a prophet, he is a leader. He is what Moses was to the people, their very substance. And he leads us, of course, to the period of David. But it's in this period of 350 years approximately that we think of and use the term the period of the judges. And generally when we talk about it, and I'd love to have you just as an exercise, it's one of those perverse things I do, try and come up with a 10-word summary. I only say 10 because that eliminates excessive verbosity. 10-word summary of the book of Judges. I want you to think about it for a moment first, though. The Lord raised up judges. It's very simple in 2:16, and I would almost use that. Because the wonderful thing about the period is that there were periods of peace, which we'll talk about a little bit later, that were lengthy. We in this country take it for granted that we've had a period of prosperity and peace, or I hope we don't take it for granted. I hope we think about it. And it's been an exceptionally long time since the Second World War. But in the midst of that, we had the Korean conflict, Vietnam conflict, Middle East wars, a number of other military excursions and foolishness. So that even in the midst of this blessed period, there has been conflict. And as we know, worldwide, there always seems to be conflict. And yet in the period of the judges, it says, and he judged Israel for 40 years, or he judged Israel for 80 years. And the implication is it was a period of peace and at least some spiritual guidance as well. I tend to flip this without any coordination. I'm a true Luddite, and Ted has told me how to press the button correctly, so I will try and do better. The authors, it's traditionally, and you'll find that, and I found in a couple of Bible dictionaries, it was probably Samuel, or they go even further. One of the perverse things that, and I'm sure they don't mean to, but we as a community should watch it, is trying to push everything away from the time that it happened. I have nothing wrong with Samuel being the editor of the book of Judges. I think he was. Traditionally, it's almost always by the Jews and by others attributed to Samuel, who may have compiled and edited the original accounts. I would agree with that. There's some number of reasons why. Summary statements such as, in those days, Israel had no king, or at the time, the house of God was at Shiloh, which indicates that the editor, at any rate, is talking about this period, because Shiloh is desecrated, destroyed, at the time that the Philistines come in at the end of Saul when he dies at Gilboa. The actual narratives, however, and this is just me, so you can challenge me and you can look into it, but the actual narratives, however, were written by the protagonists, the judges the Lord raised up. After all, why does somebody 300 years later have to tell Deborah what she sang on that day? Makes no sense whatsoever. Why does somebody have to tell Gideon, who was trembling in his boots when he crawled down with his servant and listened at the tent, what he heard? Gideon told about it. And likewise, when we read in the New Testament, it was Matthew who told about it, and Mark who told about it. He wasn't the next generation or the next century. I'll get off my hobby horse for a minute, but I think it's an important principle. The Lord raised up judges. Declarations such as, if you'll go with me, I will go. Barak was a brave fighter. He was a freedom fighter in the north in Kadesh. And yet he says to Grandma, only if you go, Deborah, will I go. He wasn't a coward. He was facing a group of tanks. He needed this prophetess. And pray, Lord, how can I deliver Israel? Convey authentic responses to their anxieties. Too much is made about heroes. And as we've seen, and I think Christian's illustrations were wonderful, Bible heroes are those that have said their prayers. Who but these actual protagonists could be so self-effacing? As I've said before, it's a little bit like Peter, who has to write about his own weakness and candid about their fears. Oh, there's a picture of them. By the way, I have myself had the audacity to make a picture, and I may share one with you tomorrow. One more. Down. Thank you. One more. There we are. There's a picture of them, and I like them because they're a jolly troop. I think it's probably the same artist, yeah. Okay. Now, the themes of the book themselves, this is just my list, it's not somebody else's, but I think it's fairly obvious if you take an intense look at the book. Levitical failure. And I want to emphasize that. It is Levitical failure. You might say, well, the people weren't paying their tithes, and therefore the Levites had to rob, steal, and cheat. But that's not quite sufficient. The Lord said to Aaron, you Your sons and your father's family are to bear the responsibility for the offenses against the sanctuary. And there are many in the Judges, both implied and actual. In Judges, both priests and Levites are immoral and or idolatrous. Shiloh is conspicuously absent from the book. The second theme is tribal factiousness, and I can't emphasize that enough. As Christadelphians, we don't know anything about arguing. But they took it to an extreme, to such an extreme that there are two civil wars, really, in the book. One is called the battle against the Benjamites, but in fact is a civil war. And it has all of the devastation of Cromwell, of our American Civil War. It is the most devastating kind of war that can be fought. It is destructive from within and from without for generations. Ephraim said, "We're going to burn down your house over your head." They said this to the man who was rejected by his own people, who went out and fought against the Ammonites and gave a great victory and delivered the Ephraimites and the Manassites and the Gadites. "We're going to burn down your house over your head, and we're going to slaughter all of you Manassites." Wonderful response. And these are the two brothers of Joseph. Oh, I'm doing it wrong, Ted. There we go. Another theme that is implied, it doesn't come out and say it, the abuse of abundance. Now, we don't have a problem with that today, do we? I suggest we do. We all are kings today. I thought of that as Christian was talking. We live like kings. In ancient time, the Roman emperor said to his slaves, "Run up Mount Etna and get me some ice." Today we go to the fridge. And I know that sounds funny, Duncan, it is funny, but it is also a sign that we are prosperous beyond all kinds of generations of people who have lived on earth. We live like kings. We really do in this country. In fact, any of you who have been to a third world country will immediately attest to that fact. "The 100,000 worth of silver I stole from your dresser, Mom." And that's a loose translation, but it's probably getting at exactly what we're going to look at next, which is the 17th chapter of the book. What I would call a postscript. "I'm returning because I fear your curse. You put the evil eye on me, Mom. So I'm returning that silver." And he probably has to cart it in a cart because it would be tremendously heavy. Whether it's worth 100,000 or whether it's worth a quarter of a million, I can't determine, because the value of money, as you know, is a sliding index. Oh, we have to look at housing prices or the stock market to realize the value of money is not a constant. But what it can purchase is fairly obvious in the scripture, and this kind of money could purchase a vast estate. There was tremendous wealth. Remember, Israel walked into a land that had vineyards that were ready because they entered it late April, Pesach. It had orchards. They had houses already built. The crops were beginning to spring from the earth. And they walked into it. They didn't have to work for it. And because God gave them the victory over many of the Canaanites in the area, and the Amorites and the other peoples, they had a built-in slave system. We read, for example, Gideon says, well, he was afraid of his family, so he secretly took 10 of his household slaves out to work for him that night. That probably says it was a household of 50 slaves. If you think about Abraham, it's the same situation. The difference, of course, with Abraham is that he becomes just a wonderful example of how to correctly use wealth and not to get a swollen head or a an idea that they are suddenly better or you are better because of your wealth. But it is a problem today, and it was a problem for the people. And we'll find that a lot of their actions and reactions are because of their tremendous prosperity and wealth. Another theme is the tribal and familial idolatry. The men of Dan went into Micah's house and took the carved image and the household gods, stole them, and then threatened to kill them all when they complained. And that, by the way, is when Joshua is still alive. We tend to think, well, idolatry develops, you know, gradually people forget. It happens instantly in Israel, and it happens covetousness with us very quickly. I say read, by the way, 1 Samuel is interesting. We won't read it, but if you look at it, one of the most godly men who has ever lived, the one who was called my beloved, had a wife who said, well, you better slip out the window so I'll put the gods in the bed to disguise. A huge idol that would look like King David, put a little fake beard on him. In David's household, there was a large god that could look like David in bed. So we should not forget that idolatry is everywhere. It's ubiquitous, even in godly households. And the attitude continues to be throughout the period, and throughout the period of the kings, that we will worship God, but we will also worship the Baals. And they had no problem with that. See, that's what Elijah is saying. How long will you be like a little bird hopping from branch to branch? Either Yahweh is God or Baal is God. You can't have it both ways. And yet, do we ever want it both ways? I love this one, and it's a very strong theme throughout the book, and we should never forget it. God delivers with the few, the fearful, and the forsaken. And I'm not just being funny when I say that. Samson was forsaken by his own family. He was betrayed by his brothers. Jesus was betrayed by his own family, but they turned back again. Samson's family buried him finally and probably had some remorse. It certainly was the few. God says, and in fact in these examples you can see, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest. Well, the Abiezerites were technically weak, though the meaning is a bit obscure because Saul says the same thing. And yet Saul was a huge man and his family was very powerful. I think it may be humility on his case, but it's the way he felt. In Judges 7, with 300 men, I will save you. They didn't save themselves. God saved them. With 300 men, I choose to save them. And we'll talk about that a little later. It's a fascinating way in which God brings them down to a very small group. Judges 11, Gilead's son drove Jephthah away. Jephthah was probably the bravest of the judges. He was a warlord. He was a mighty man because of necessity. And yet, the sons drove him away. Why? To get the inheritance, of course. Kick him out of the house. We get it all. And Judges 15, then 3,000 men from Judah said to Samson, we've come to tie you up and hand you over to the Philistines because you're a pain in the neck. Well, the last part I've added. But think about the horror of that. Here is a man who had risked his life, who is filled with the Spirit of God, and 3,000 men of Judah come down, grab him, and say, we've come to hand you to the Philistines to get rid of the problem. Does that sound like But the Romans are going to come and take away our temple. It's expedient that one man die for the people. It's the same kind of thinking. Oh, there he is. The structural cycle, and by the way, I don't have any objection to your pulling another letter. I have a chart up here, but you can see it up there. Disobedience, defeat, distress, devotion. In the middle section of Judges, that cycle is very, very obvious. I don't even think I'll give you an example of it because it happens over and over. It is the history of mankind. It's the history of Israel. It's the history of all human nature. Disobedience, defeat, distress on a personal level, on a national level, on a tribal level, and yet then devotion, turning, repentance, and deliverance by God. If you didn't get a chance, you can come up with any other words in there. It doesn't have to be D's. I don't know why I like D's that day. There are 12 judges, and some have said, well, that was everything in Judges is set up in a structural way. We've got 40 years repeated over and over, and it's just a convenient number. That is true, however, there are a number of very specific periods, such as 6 years, 12 years, 11 years, 18 years, in the book itself. So I don't think the answer for the 12 judges is convenient. There are seven of them who are really saviors and who are emphasized between chapter 3 and at the end of chapter 16. Well, actually six, excuse me, because Samuel comes, of course, later. I think the judges should have been Levitical. It never spells it out, but if you'll take a look with me just quickly at the passage from Deuteronomy, the 17th chapter. I don't think I have it written down. 17th of Deuteronomy, beginning at verse 8. If any case arises, and by the way, he's already talked about judges. If your eye goes back from the 8th verse to the 16th chapter and the 18th verse, you shall appoint judges and officers in all your towns. So there was a local magistrate. And we can understand that. We have one today. But in the 17th chapter and the 8th verse, if any case arises requiring the decision between one kind of homicide and another, one kind of legal right and another, one kind of assault and another, any case within your towns which is too difficult for you, then you shall arise and go to the place which the Lord your God will choose, and coming to the Levitical priest and to the judge who is in office in those days, you shall consult them, and they will declare to you the decision. When they came to Deborah, that's the kind of decision they wanted. The local magistrate was not up to the task. They came to Deborah. They came to Gideon. I think they should have been Levitical, but as I've suggested, and I may be offending people, this little picture that we often give the kids of the wonderful priest, if anything, if there's a failure in Israel, it first starts with the priest. They are the most responsible before the judge, before the king. And the only one who I think absolutely fulfills that role is Samuel. Because he is that. He is the judge of the people. He is a prophet. He is compassionate. He works a circuit, so he helps a number of people. Malachi 2:7, you will remember that it is a charge for the priests that they should have been teachers, they should have been counselors, they should have been helpers, and they had abused their position. Ah, I am going to include Ruth because Ruth is a part of the book of the Judges. Because she has a separate name, we assign it to a different period somehow in our mind, and we say, well, that's not a part of the Judges, and it's very much a part of the Judges, and it's a wonderful part of the Judges. Structure of the text, and you'll excuse this, this is technical, and that's why I'm using a flash drive today. Tomorrow I'll just be talking. There is a prologue, chapters 1 through 3, 6, and you can see it's distinctive. It introduces us after the death of Joshua. There is a failure of faith to conquer all of the territory which God had given them, which includes all of Lebanon, by the way, which was never taken. And then in 2:6 through 3:6, there is the apostasy and the affliction which is immediately brought upon the people because of their apostasy. The middle section, the structure is, of course, obvious. It is the seven, those God chose to be saviors and judges, their trials and their triumphs. Specifically, the seven saviors, the Hebrew Yashah. By the way, as a test, how many judges are found in the faithful in Hebrews 11? Anybody know? Somebody? Oh, it says, you're right. I didn't realize. I got to watch that. Okay, good. Good, Joan got it right away. How many kings? That's not fair. Not fair. Sorry, Christian. There's one. Right. But he at that point interjects and says, but time would fail me to go on and speak of others. So it could be there's some other kings. I suspect there are. But he picks up the judges because they're exceptional people. They're like us. They have feet of clay. They're fearful. They're often, like Samson, probably not good Christadelphians. But they're included in Hebrews 11 because of their exceptional faith. And because in the period of their judgeship, they judged Israel. They brought them back to some spiritual context. Just how much is difficult to say, but it definitely makes the point of saying when the judge died, then they returned to idolatry or whatever the situation was. We're going to begin with the postscripts. I don't think we'll make it very far, but I want you to look at them. There are three sections. Micah's priest, which you will be familiar with. We've made reference to his problem with Mammon stealing $100,000 worth of silver. But it does emphasize Levitical failure. And I think we probably should pick up at that right now. The Civil War, of course, is the period in which we are horrified by, and we should be horrified by. It's Gibeah's sin, the sin of Sodom, the sin of abundance, and the sin of arrogance by all of the other tribes. I don't think we will right now take a look at that. Ruth is a triumph of faithfulness. It's an absolutely thrilling book to read. It's still read by those trying to learn Hebrew. I remember Jesse said in Israel that was the book, you know, that they looked at, because it has that wonderful cycle of loss, and it just goes through to blessing and faith. So, let's turn to the actual. As I say, we probably won't get very far, but there's a couple of other judges, and by the way, the implements that they're using are very often those they fought with. Remember, the iron fabrication came from the island of Crete for the most part and was coming in with waves from the Philistines, the people of the sea at the time. So this makes them heroes in the sense, I guess we can see, if you pick up a club and go against a tank, that's pretty nice. Micah's priest. And maybe I will just continue with a flash drive here, but as we look at the 17th chapter, it talks about the hill country of Ephraim. It doesn't mean the tribe of Ephraim, by the way. Tribe of Ephraim is a pretty much of a failure throughout the book of Judges. It means the hill country, which continues from Judah through Benjamin, through Ephraim, through Manasseh, through Issachar. That whole hill country to Mount Gilboa, and really continuing on down to Hebron in the south. We've already seen the illustration, Mom, I'm sorry I took it, but you gave me a curse, and so I'm returning. Blessed are you, my son, by the Lord. Now, you talk about irony. We said before, they have no problem going back and forth, worshiping Baal one day or maybe the same day, praising God. Praise God, I'm going to make you a couple of wonderful idols because you've returned the money. And those were expensive idols, and the shocker should be that there was somebody in town who was a good idol maker already. And this is in the period of Joshua. As I say, and I'm not trying to be flippant again, the silversmith immediately makes a couple of dandy idols, and everybody's happy. Micah's son becomes a priest. I mean, after all you have to do is wear a fancy garment and you become a priest, right? No king is the comment made, I think, by Samuel. And I leave that as a question, but I think that's a very deliberate comment that he makes throughout. And remember that has two sides to it. We'll talk about it tomorrow. There's no king, there's no great leader such as David, but then there's no tyrant such as Saul. Young Levite is from Bethlehem, remember that, because these two postscripts at the end of the book, I would include Ruth as the third postscript, these two all contain two cities. And the two cities, of course, are the cities of the first two kings, one who is a tremendous failure and the other who is a wonderful example, King David. The two cities of Gibeah and Bethlehem are mentioned more times in this section than any other place. Are the tithes being paid? And that's simply a question mark I don't have the answer to. I suspect they're not because of idolatry, because of corruption, because of failure, both by the Levites and by the people, but particularly by the Levites. I can't do this, Ted. It takes great... there we go. In the 18th chapter, of course, we have Dan's dissension. The Amorites, by the way, the Philistines are not in great force in the area which we call the five-city area, the Philistines, at this time. They are there established from the time of Abraham, but they come in waves from Crete. And so these people of the sea have not arrived in their massive force as they do later in the period of the Judges, probably 100 years after the early period. In the early period, it's the Amorites who are the power that drives the Danites out. And the Danites fail, as so many of the tribes fail, to convince their fellows, their brothers, to help them defeat the Amorites. Everybody tries to do it by themselves. And I think there is such enmity between tribes that it's almost as sad as the fact that the Amorites prevail over the Danites because of their lack of faith. Joshua essentially has already told them, God has given this to you. All you have to do is go. And the Danites, of course, pick up and head into the hill country of Ephraim, the central massif, if you will, the wonderful area of the a deep aquifer and up towards Shechem. Verse 3. Think about this. The Danites get to this probably remote spot somewhere outside of Shechem, into this estate of Micah, and they recognize the voice of the priest. Now remember, the priest comes out of Bethlehem. Bethlehem is not a city of priests. The place where Micah is has his son, an idolatrous priest, and idols. And this Levite is recognized by his voice, and they say, "What are you doing here?" As if to say they knew him. And I want you to think about that, because they did know him. They knew him from Bethlehem and perhaps from the surrounding towns. Lahu Shalom Yahweh approves. That's the comment made about setting up this Levite as a priest. Yahweh approves. Yahweh approves of everything. Go with my blessing, says this priest. And so he blesses the spies from Dan who go up to Lachish, and spy out the area. They find that it is, I have the Hebrew Batach. Remember, Batach is the wonderful principle mentioned in Ezekiel 36, security, safety. It's the word used by Isaiah to describe the blessings of the kingdom age. It not only means peace, but a sense of contentment, a sense of prosperity, a sense of safety. The war party of the Danites then decides that we will go up and we will murder all of the men, women, and children and take over this territory. The territory itself is really legitimately within the boundaries that Moses described, but the way in which they do it is obviously treacherous on a number of levels. They failed to take the inheritance where the lot had fallen to them through lack of faith, and this war party goes up to the pass at Kiriath Jearim. There is a pass which goes through, and it would be the natural way to head up through the Har, through the mountainous area, on the road to Bethel. We have kidnapping, robbery, and the priest is then happy when he's kidnapped, when they rob Micah, when they steal, the gods, when they threaten Micah with his life. But the priest is happy. And remember, he's not even a priest. He's simply a Levite. He's happy because he's going to be important. He's going to be the priest for the whole tribe of Dan. And they have two wonderful idols to start off a happy, happy time. There is a great deal of irony in this. I don't think we'll look at Jude 6. I don't think I printed it out. But we'll find the same thing prevailed in that time. In verse 30, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites till the death of Saul and the captivity which followed. End of class one. But I want you to think about that. If you have, how many have King James here? What does it say in the King James? Does it say anything about that? If you have that text, verse 30, chapter 18, it doesn't say Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests. It says something different. What does it say? It says Manasseh, doesn't it? Now, I have wonderful confidence that we have a correct Old Testament canon. In fact, there's no question that it's more accurate than the New Testament canon. The Jews were scrupulously careful to follow the text exactly. But when it came to Moses' grandson, they lied. They deliberately changed the Hebrew. There's no question that it is Jonathan, the grandson of Moses, who was this idolatrous priest in the section that we've read. And it's a lesson for us. If we set up somebody as great and their grandson is not great, let's accept the fact that God has called us and blessed us, but there's nothing in inheritance that makes us better than anybody else. And it's a sad comment about Jonathan that he couldn't accept the fact that he was not to be great. He was not to be a priest. He was simply the grandson of Moses, and he was equal to any one of us.